Hello, I'm Robin Williams, and welcome to the 2014 Boyer Lectures. In her last lecture, Professor Suzanne Corey, former director of the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute in Melbourne, talked of her early career and how she enjoyed the brilliant leadership of legends such as Francis Crick and Fred Sanger, who had three Nobel Prizes between them. This time she shows how extraordinarily important scientific R&D is for our economy. Which manufacturing industry, for instance, do you imagine leads Australian exports in recent times? Well, the answer, surprising to some, is medical technology. All those apnea machines, vaccines and bionic devices. The fascination of these lectures is the way Professor Corey reflects on her own life and family, talking personally and movingly, and then shows how the science for which she has such a passion is the very basis of our future. So here is Suzanne Corey, the first woman to be elected President of the Australian Academy of Science, with her second Boyer lecture, Science for a Healthy Economy.
When I first sat down at my desk to think about these lectures, my 18-month-old granddaughter Lyra came into the room and started gleefully rifling through the books. Her presence made me think about what her world will be like in the decades to come. I mused about my own life and started to think about what I want hers to be. Many of my hopes and fears for Lyra are undoubtedly shared by you. So what do we need to do in Australia today to secure health and prosperity for our children and grandchildren tomorrow? I've had a privileged life. I grew up in Melbourne in a family rich in love, although not money, and my brother, sister and I received an excellent education in government schools. My father was an accountant by day, mended our school shoes in the garage at night, and built us a beach shack with his own hands. My mother looked after us all and served the local community. Although the long shadow of World War II and Korea still lingered, its impact was muted by the oceans that separate Australia from the rest of the world. We walked or rode our bikes to school without fear. And our family camping holidays gave us a deep and lifelong affinity with the Australian bush and deserts and beaches. I was born a feminist and I grew up convinced that girls can do anything. As a child, my aspirations ranged from being a novelist to becoming an astronaut. But instead, inspired by a wonderful high school teacher, I became a scientist. In 1961, I went to the University of Melbourne on a Commonwealth scholarship, fulfilling a dream denied to my parents by the Depression. I did my PhD at Cambridge, actually supported by a British scholarship because the few Australian scholarships available at that time were explicitly restricted to males. My time in Cambridge at the world-famous MRC Laboratory of Molecular Biology taught me that science is a vocation, not a job. And there too, I met my wonderful partner in life and science, Gerry Adams. Later, Gerry and I set up our own lab back in Melbourne at the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute of Medical Research. And we've worked there ever since. This world-famous research centre enabled us to compete in science at the highest level while raising our two daughters in Australia within the loving embrace of my extended family. What have I learned from my own story to want for Lyra? What I want most for her is to enjoy good health and a happy family life. I also want her to have an excellent education and attain the full potential of her talents. I want her to have a high-quality, fulfilling job that she enjoys, to be able to wake up every morning wanting to go to work, like I still do after 45 years in the lab. And I want her to have the leisure time and income to develop broad interests and activities. I want Lyra's Australia to be peaceful and tolerant, rich in science and the arts, with a strong commitment to social equity and cohesion. I want her nation to be exciting, vibrant and innovative. I want the cities to be visually beautiful, full of trees and parks. I want her to be able to experience unspoiled natural wilderness throughout the continent. And I want her to feel proud that Australia is a good global citizen. But in my gloomy moments, I worry that my vision for Lyra is unattainable. In the recent past, Australia has provided a secure, prosperous life for most of its people, although shamefully, we continue to leave many behind. Our rich natural resources have enabled us to supply the burgeoning needs of China and other countries in our region, and buffered us against the economic downturns experienced recently by many other nations. We enjoy access to abundant fresh food and water, spacious housing, good health care, and quality education. And our average wages have increased steadily over the past 20 years and are 37% higher in real terms than they were in 1994. But as I gaze towards Lyra's future, there is certainly no guarantee that Australia will continue to prosper or that we'll be able to improve the lives of our less fortunate citizens. Indeed, it seems to me that Australia is at a tipping point. The possibility that we could slide seriously backwards was brought into sharp focus by the recent collapse of the automotive industry. Australia's traditional manufacturing sector lost 87,000 jobs in the last 5 years and is projected to lose another 40,000 in the next five. Experts also forecast a net loss of more than 12,000 mining jobs in the next 5 years as China's demand for resources slows down. And our vast backyard quarry is diminishing. Discovery of new deposits have not kept pace with depletion, despite the significant effort that's gone into exploration. Even though we fondly believe we're in an egalitarian society, this is rapidly becoming a myth, threatening our social cohesion. Income inequalities are now at 19th century levels in many developed countries, and Australia's income disparity is trending in the same direction. The government's recent austerity measures will hit the economically disadvantaged hard and further deepen the social divide. Australia's population is growing at one of the fastest rates of any nation, 1.5% per year on average, and I can't resist adding that boat arrivals are only a tiny proportion of this. By 2061, our population is projected to be somewhere between 37 million and 48 million. While this growth will bring opportunities, it will also bring challenges for our environmental and urban sustainability and for our food and water resources. And the ageing demographic will challenge our social and health system. Climate change is also imposing increasing stress. Droughts, bushfires and floods are forecast to increase in frequency and intensity, imposing huge economic, cultural and ecological costs. Maintaining our quality of life in the face of these and other challenges will depend on many factors, including, very crucially, ongoing economic prosperity. It's simply not an option to hang on and hope that circumstances will change. We must actively fashion our own circumstances. As economist Don Russell, former Secretary of the Department of Innovation and Science, urged in his recent Crawford Reflections lecture, and I paraphrase, we must become the country of economic transformation. How are we going to achieve this economic transformation? In my view, this will be crucially dependent on investment in research, innovation, and education. It may seem counterintuitive, but our resource riches have actually hindered us from becoming sufficiently innovative and competitive. Many of the countries that are now the strongest economically lack huge natural resources. They've become strong by investing in their people, in education, and in science. Denmark, Korea, Singapore, and Japan are good examples. Australia must learn from these success stories. Currently, almost all of our new technology comes from somewhere else. Only 2% of the new technologies used by Australian firms have been developed here. 2%! A recent report from Australia's Council of Learned Academies stresses the urgent need to ramp up our own innovation capacity. Time is not on our side, it warns. In the past 10 years, other countries have moved ahead of us. And although we'll continue to profit from our natural resources, from mining, agriculture, and tourism, we must add more value before sending our wares offshore. And although our service sector has grown handsomely and created many jobs, we also need to make things, patent ideas, produce high-quality products and services that are highly sought after by the world's markets. We must progress from traditional to advanced manufacturing. We must incorporate innovative technologies, materials and processes into product design, production and marketing. We have the talent to do this, aided by our scientists. In the last lecture, I spoke about some of Australia's economic success stories in medicine and medical technology. There are many others. Tomorrow morning, when you put on your glasses or pop in disposable contact lenses, you can thank Australian scientists. And soon the hope is for a bionic eye that will restore sight to the blind. Every time you use cash, you're paying with long-lasting and unforgeable polymer banknotes, developed by David Solomon and Ezio Rizzardo at CSIRO. You'll also find their advanced polymers in paints, lubricants and adhesives. And soon you'll be able to charge your social media devices as you walk, because your clothing will have flexible solar cells sewn into it, thanks to discoveries by Professor Andrew Holmes. These are great stories, and there are many more. But unless our government and businesses urgently invest more in research and development, we simply will not sustain this kind of success. The brightest people will head overseas, where they'll find willing investors and developers. In actual fact, Australia's total investment in R&D is below the OECD average and lags well behind that of the leaders, Israel, Finland and Korea. Investment in science, research and innovation by the Australian government has actually fallen for the last 2 years. In 2011-12, it invested $9.1 billion, but by the end of the last financial year, this had dropped by 5% to only $8.6 billion. This is extremely short-sighted. At the very least, our investment should be on a par with the OECD average, with the aim to exceed it, and soon. And it must be consistent and long-term. Frequent changes in government policy and stop-start support undermines confidence and inhibits the risk-taking required for step change. Equally important as strong investment in research and development is strong support for education, because the education of our future workforce is absolutely vital if we want to transform our economy. Many of the jobs our children and grandchildren will have when they leave school and university do not yet exist. Indeed, we cannot even imagine what they might be. But we can say with absolute certainty that many of the new well-paid jobs will emerge from or depend upon science and technology. Already the trend is clear. Over the next 5 years, more than 88,000 new jobs will be created in the professional, scientific and technical area. Even for non-scientists and non-technologists, a sound science education will be essential because our leaders and citizens must be able to operate effectively within a technologically advanced world. It follows that science, maths and engineering will need to be a major focus in our education system. Arguably the major focus. President Obama is acutely aware of the importance of science to the economy and international competitiveness, remarking, and I quote, "We know that the nation that goes all in on innovation today will own the global economy tomorrow." Accordingly, he has set as a national goal that American students should move from the middle to the top of the international pack in science and maths over the next decade. Unfortunately, the story is very different in Australia. Our performance in science and maths education is failing, while that of our Asian rivals is surging ahead. 2012 figures show that Australian teenagers performed worse in science than their peers in China, Singapore, Japan, Finland, Estonia, and Korea. In fact, the difference between students in Australia and those in Shanghai amounts to almost 2 years of schooling. In maths, the picture is even worse, with 16 countries scoring higher than Australia. Again, Shanghai scored the highest, and in this case, the difference was just over 3 years of schooling. This decline is of grave concern because mathematics is an enabling science. Without maths, it's not possible to make use of other sciences, either in the lab or in the workforce. As my friend and great Australian mathematician Nalini Joshi reminds us, and I quote, "The pathway towards economic diversity and opportunity is paved with mathematics. Mathematics can show us how to minimise traffic snarls in our cities, cut costs in a complex network of rail transportation, avoid congestion on the internet, weigh costs and benefits of environmental policies, and optimise a small business plan." What is the cause of this declining interest of Australian students in science and maths? Why do teens lose that burning spirit of inquiry that drives them as young children? Every scientist I know has a story about the teacher who first inspired them. We need to nurture such teachers more effectively and produce more of them. We must value them more highly, and we must pay them accordingly. But the reality is that most Australian primary teachers have not studied science, and therefore they lack confidence in teaching science. And even in our secondary schools, science and maths is often taught by teachers with poor training in these areas. Perhaps because of this, traditional chalk and talk teaching, copying notes and cookbook practical lessons are still far too prevalent. Anybody with a teenager in their lives knows that such an approach holds little appeal. Social media and internet games habituate them to high engagement and instant feedback. New education programs developed for primary and junior secondary school by the Australian Academy of Science are beginning to turn the tide. These programs do away with chalk and talk entirely and emphasise teaching science through hands-on inquiry. Both are fully aligned with the national curriculum and they're highly effective in keeping students engaged and improving their learning. To me, nothing is more important for Australia than providing every child with the best education we can afford. Our children and our grandchildren deserve nothing less. I saw firsthand at my government school how high-quality education enabled the children of poor immigrant families to become leaders in our society in just one generation. As a nation, the vast bulk of our education dollar should be used to address inequity in education and make quality education available for every Australian child, rather than for further enhancing infrastructure in wealthy private schools. The recommendations for education reform made by David Gonski displayed great vision. We must not let this vision wither, as now seems to be happening. Equally, we must not allow increased university fees and hex changes to discourage or prevent our brightest young people from obtaining high-quality tertiary education. Moving from transforming our workforce to transforming the economy, how should Australia be planning for knowledge and innovation-based industries? Sometimes, the breakthroughs that drive innovation can be planned for, but more often, they develop unexpectedly, from blue sky research, the kind of research that's done purely for the sake of discovery. 50 years on, the awesome accomplishments of the Apollo program still seem like Star Wars science fiction. But the spin-off partnerships between NASA and industry yielded countless innovations we use every day. Innovations like building insulation, sports textiles, water purification, and freeze-dried food, to mention just a few. The Human Genome Project, too, began as a voyage of pure discovery to map and sequence all our genes. But the knowledge and technology that it has spawned has transformed pharmaceutical, diagnostic, agricultural, and many other industries. For every dollar invested, The project has already returned more than $65 to the US economy, a whopping $965 billion in total. And while that phenomenal rate of return is sinking in, I'd like you to take a moment to imagine a world without Wi-Fi. A world without Wi-Fi? Teens around the nation would shudder at the thought. Many of you may not realise it, but Wi-Fi is a great Australian example of a transforming technology that developed from blue sky research. The story began in 1977 when John O'Sullivan and his CSIRO colleagues published a paper about improving the clarity of their radio telescope images. In the 90s, the team adapted this method to reduce interference for radio signals. And now their technology is embedded in millions of computers, phones, cameras, tablets, and games. We use Wi-Fi-enabled devices every day, and we're addicted to them. The former UK Minister for Universities and Science, David Willetts, has spoken compellingly about government's role in stimulating fundamental cutting-edge research to transform industry. His vision is for the UK to become the world's best R&D lab, and he's chosen eight areas for major new investment: big data, space, robotics and autonomous systems, synthetic biology, regenerative medicine, agri-science, advanced materials, and energy. What about us? Which areas of Australian science could propel us forward? Well, medical research, astronomy, physics, chemistry, and robotics, for a start. Astronomy has already spawned the most exciting and challenging mega science program that Australia's ever been involved in: the Square Kilometre Array, or SKA. This is a project that offers huge opportunities, not only to our astronomers and astrophysicists, but also to many of our industries. I'm sure you've seen, or at least heard of, the iconic Australian movie The Dish, which brought radio telescopes into our popular culture, telling how the Parkes Dish in New South Wales relayed humankind's first steps on the moon to televisions across the world. Well, the SKA is to the Parkes radio telescope as the smartphone is to the oldest dial phone. It's a gigantic $2.2 billion radio telescope with a receiving surface of 1 million square metres. Hundreds of small antennae distributed over several thousand kilometres will act together as a single giant telescope that has spectacular resolution. The SKA will be located in the radio quiet deserts of Western Australia and South Africa, with an unparalleled view of the Milky Way. Construction will begin in 2 years, and it's being funded jointly by 9 countries, including, of course, Australia. There's never been anything like this. By giving scientists the ability to see much further across the universe than ever before, and in greater detail, this amazing instrument will allow us to look back in time. It will enable us to explore the origin and history of the universe, illuminate the mysterious nature of dark matter and dark energy, and learn more about black holes and cosmic radiation. The scale of the SKA is truly mind-blowing. Humanity is estimated to have spoken 5 million words in its entire history. But the SKA will collect the equivalent amount of information in just its first week of operation. Indeed, the dishes will produce 10 times the data of current global internet traffic and use enough optical fibre to wrap twice around the Earth. The impact of the SKA will extend well beyond astrophysics. It will provide hundreds of high-value jobs, both on-site and in diverse supporting industries. It'll revolutionise communication and information technology, because the means to handle the huge volumes of data from that desert network does not yet exist. So the project will push scientists and engineers to improve signal processing, storage and computation, as well as sensor technology. It'll also drive major innovation in wireless communication. The SKA has set itself the ambitious challenge of running on 100% locally generated renewable energy. And striving to achieve this goal will accelerate developments in generating and storing green power and bring new and improved methods for distributing that power. Two precursor facilities have already been built in the desert, 800 kilometres north of Perth. CSIRO's Australian SKA Pathfinder, or ASCAP, and the Murchison Wide Field Array, belonging to an international consortium of universities. These projects are already providing jobs, harvesting information about the universe, and creating new knowledge. In concluding, our achievements of the past, our Wi-Fi, our medical breakthroughs, our plastics technology, make me proud to be an Australian scientist. And projects like the SKA make me very excited about the future of Australian science and technology. We have so much potential. We have the knowledge and the drive to transform Australia into a vibrant, innovative, responsive, and resilient economy. With strong support for education, scientific infrastructure, research and development, Australia can be the kind of nation that I dream of for Lyra and for all of our children and grandchildren.
So it's R&D or RIP. Professor Suzanne Corey is a former president of the Australian Academy of Science. Next time in her third Boyer lecture, she talks about our environment.
The era of change that is upon us now is not due to natural causes. It's of our making. Humankind is fouling the nest.
Suzanne Corey and the Boyer Lectures, and the book of this lecture series is available at the ABC shops now. You're on RN, I'm Robin Williams.